people of Western Europe. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
We're on board the car ferry Normandy out of Rosslare, heading for the coast of France in relative comfort and safety. But 60 years ago, on the 5th of June 1944, perhaps up to a million young men, thousands of them Irish, were waiting on the coast of England, stomachs knotted with tension, pulses racing, for the start of Operation Overlord. On the morning of the 6th of June 1944, the invasion of Europe began. Because the Allies used a very tight weather window, the Germans weren't expecting the invasion, not in Normandy, not in Calais, not anywhere at that time. They thought the weather had made them impregnable, but it wasn't to be, and there was an extraordinary lapse in German intelligence. They didn't know that the invasion was taking place until the German sentries woke up on the morning of June the 6th to see the biggest invasion fleet ever assembled. And then the bombardment started. Teenager, André Einz saw the first German uniforms walking the streets of his native Caen, the administrative capital of Normandy. The screw of repression turned slowly. He was recruited to a resistance cell by a priest, but the Gestapo were effective. 2,500 resistance members in his area were arrested, tortured, and killed. 86 of them, many close to young Einz, were detained just 2 weeks before the invasion. On the morning of that invasion, they were dragged out into a prison yard and killed. Einz survived, and after years of sabotage and intelligence gathering, eagerly awaited news of the impending invasion.
Nobody was told where it would take place, except wrong places. And the Germans were also fooled by fortitude. In April and May 44, they announced in our newspapers at least three times the date of the landings, which was wrong, of course, so that looked like fools after that. And after the second half of May, and of course less in June, they never mentioned that anymore. So we were told, of course, on the 1st of May to be prepared for action. And there was a message for each different region of France, which was different, which was called the warning, and the leaders had to prepare plans, the general order being, when you hear those messages, you must hamper all German means of communication as much as you can for the next 10 hours. And those main three sentences were heard on the evening of the 5th, I still remember them clearly. There was one, the warning on the 1st of June was for this part of France, l'heure, and I'll say it in French, du combat viendra, the time of the fight will come.
By 1944, it's estimated that 165,000 young citizens of ERA had joined the British Armed Forces. There were thousands too in the US Army. One veteran estimates that 66,000 Irish men in British uniforms fought in Normandy. One of them is now called Brother Columbanus, a Franciscan friar. But then he was Sean Deegan from Usher's Island in Dublin, already a veteran of Bomber Command on special duties, issued with a Harley-Davidson motorcycle and instructions to track down crashed aircraft identify the dead, and note any parts of the aircraft worth salvaging. They landed him on the Normandy beaches behind the main force. But how did the journey from Usher's Island to France begin?
My motivation was entirely adventure. When the war broke out, I was a senior scout. I was into scouting. I was into all that sort of life, outdoor life and adventure. I come from an unusual background in the sense that my father went off in the First World War with his two brothers, and he was lucky to be wounded, survived. He left his two brothers out there. And like most of the stories, he was very reluctant to talk about it. The only thing, we had photographs of the brothers, and if I got him going in the photographs, he'd tell us all. Now, I was born, you see, just after the Civil War, and my heroes were the IRA and the people who, Dan Breen, my fight for Irish freedom. And oh, I was a Christian Brother student, so our teachers were all Republican. I know all the Republican songs. For our day off, we were taken out to the mountains and we were on manoeuvres, literally, with the lads, rehearsing the battles that they'd won. So my whole background was like that in one sense, because my mother, Lord rest her, her two brothers, one of them had been killed in 1916, Republican. The other guy fled the country, managed to escape, ended up in Canada. So I was brought up in that background of militarism. And most of it was where in Dublin, hearing stories and knowing this and the adventure. And when the war broke out, we thought that was brilliant. You know, those few battles going on and wars, a lot of propaganda. But however, to make a long story longer, as they say, I decided I was going to join the Irish Army with three of my pals, because the emergency was started. They were clamouring for people to join. And we went up in the early 40s, we were 40, maybe 41, up to Portobello Barracks to join the Irish Army. And my whole idea was to try and get into the Air Corps. I was mad on aeroplanes. I'd been to an air display up in the Phoenix Park, and I fell in love with aeroplanes. And I remember the poor officer who was interviewing them. We had a big queue. They were queuing to join the Irish Army at that time. I was queues outside the barracks. We took our place and went in. And he interviewed me, and he said, well, of course, he didn't believe me for a start off, that I was, as I said, I was telling him I was 18. He says, no, you're not even 17. I'm young looking now, I suppose, from over 80. So, and he says, besides, he says, you're too skinny. He says, you're too skinny altogether. Go home, he says, go back in about a year. Feed yourself up and back in again, and we'll talk to you again. Out. And I was out the door, and I was disgusted. And my two pals got in. And here was I, sent home with my tail between my legs. But I heard a few, through the grapevine system, I heard a few months afterwards that the RAF were looking for guys, and they didn't mind you being skinny, nor they didn't mind you, your
probably
age.
Helped.
So they said, so I wrote away to the British Embassy, and lo and behold, they sent me on. Okay, they've done a little bit of vetting of you, all right, I know this, you're told about this. And when I, after a week or two, I got a letter to say, report to the Amin Street station, and you'll be met at Gower Wood, and wear your old clothes, and you'll, if you blah, blah, blah. And that's what happened.
The Irish government of the day issued only 771 permits for men of military age to leave the state during the emergency. But they poured over the border to the recruiting offices of Belfast, or on to Scotland or England. They were scattered across every branch and every regiment of the British forces. Tom Meehan was just another young, unemployed Dubliner at the outbreak of war.
There was no jobs, and I had listened to the elderly people then who had been in the First World War, and we thought it was great excitement, and we said we'd chances. So why we never joined our own army, I'll never know. I'll never be able to answer that one at all.
Well, how did you actually go about joining up?
I just begged and borrowed the fare to Belfast. My mother was prepared to give it to me and let me go to her, and that's what happened. Then we went to Clifton Street in Belfast, and in the recruiting office.
Did you have any choice of regiment or which branch of the army?
You had, but that was another thing. I knew nothing about that whatsoever. And only going up in the train, people were talking. But a lot of other people were going, of course, not just me. And they were talking about joining the East Surreys. Now, why or how the East Surreys or who they were, I didn't know, or what they were. So, joined the East Surreys. And then, for some reason or other, when we got across to England, we were transferred to the West Kents. Subsequent to that, a bloke came along and he was looking for volunteers for the Airborne Division.
This was brand new now. This was a brand new division of
It's a brand new division, British exactly. Army. That's correct, yes. And when we arrived, Newbury, the race course, it was the Royal Ulster Rifles. We could have joined that in Belfast when we joined up first.
And was this to train as a paratrooper or as a glider-borne soldier?
Glider-borne troops. Yeah, we thought it was the paratroops, but when he did explain to us that it was airborne, he didn't define between glider and paratroop and parachute.
Critical to the success of the invasion was an attack on a series of bridges, the best known, codenamed Pegasus Bridge. The target of airborne troops, a huge proportion of which were drawn from this island. Mark Worthington is a military historian attached to senior guide to the museum at Pegasus Bridge. What was so important that the success of an entire invasion swung on the taking of that bridge and the destruction of others?
Taking the bridges, they did prevent the German forces coming across the Orne and the canal, but the principal reason was to allow the reinforcements coming up from the beach and the heavy weapons, the tanks and guns, to cross, because 6th Airborne Division was dropped to the east of the Orne and the canal.
Tell me the story, the chronology of it. What time did they land?
The gliders, they were glider-borne troops involved in the taking of the bridges, of course. They landed at 16, 17 and 18 minutes past midnight on the night of the 5th of June, that is the morning of the 6th of June, 7 hours before the troops came ashore onto the beaches.
How many men?
180 men.
Just?
Transported in 6 Horsa gliders. In each one there were 30 men, 28 troops, fully equipped, and the 2 pilots.
Did all the gliders get down safely?
5 landed near the 2 bridges, 3 of them near Pegasus Bridge.
One of them within 50 yards?
47 yards.
My goodness.
Precisely. The troops measured the distance on the 8th of June 1944.
What size was the German garrison here?
There were 11 troops garrisoned next to the bridge. 9 of them were sleeping in a bunker next to the bridge when the British arrived. 2 of them were on the bridge.
See, I talked to one of the veterans of that engagement, and he described it as silent killing.
Yes. Well, the 9 troops in the bunker were killed by the British. They went down and put them out of action. They were still asleep in the bunker.
With a knife?
Yeah, quite.
Pretty horrific stuff, really.
Yes, but these men were trained to do that.
That was the job.
Yes, quite.
When you hit the ground, what were your orders then? What did you do?
Get out and get onto the ground. Get out of that glider as fast as you could. Because if you can understand, it was stationary then. A machine gunner with any sort of shot at all could have killed a lot of us, because the glider wouldn't save you.
And the glider was only, bits of wood and fabric?
Yeah, that's all. Matchwood.
So you hit the ground.
Yes.
What was your weapon?
Oh, rifle. Oh, the best man of the lot. Oh, God, the sniper was good at picking out the machine gunners. And the revolver wouldn't do 100 yards, so...
Stem gun, too short range as well.
Yes.
And the Bren gun, too heavy for carrying around.
Well, it wasn't. They got used to us. I was second to a machine gunner who unfortunately was killed at my feet on the first attack.
Was he a man you knew well?
I did. I knew him well. Sammy Glass by name. He was a Belfast chap. And in my opinion, for what it's worth, he would have been Northern Ireland's goalkeeper.
Really?
He would. He was that good.
What age were you at this stage?
20.
20?
I was 16 and 10 months when I joined up, and then 20 when I going into action.
How many of your friends did you see die?
How
many of them?
Well, you didn't get time to see them dying. You heard them screaming with pain, or some of them calling out for their mammies or their girlfriends or whatever. But you weren't allowed to pick them up because you had to get out. When we did charge the little place called St. Henry in, they were there waiting for us. And then we got the order to get back, because it was no use. We were overrun.
So what happened then? You ran up, the German machine gunners would have opened up?
Yes, they'd all sorts, yes. All sorts of heavy machinery, machine guns. Yes, I don't understand how we weren't all wiped out. Again, I repeat myself for what it's worth. When we got back to Longaval, where we landed originally, we were told to get into the ground, dig in. Now, why did he allow us to dig in? After all, he had all the machinery there to blast us off the face of the earth. But he gave it to us when we got into the ground, which was comparatively safe.
This was the German general, obviously, in charge of the defence.
Somebody slipped up, all right, thank God.
They let you dig in.
Yes, they let us dig in.
And that was a fatal mistake.
In my opinion, yes.
At first it was thousands of planes. We didn't know why they were there, except that there were some bombings, but far away, and we couldn't quite determine where it was, and we had not guessed that they were in fact dropping something like 10,000 parachutists. And after 2 o'clock, it was more bombing. At 3:30 in the morning, it was rather terrific as far as bombing was concerned, but it has even made worse with the noise of from the Navy. Navy shells make a terrific noise. It even frightened the Germans to death. And by 4:30, it was obvious from the noise heard towards the north and the sky, which was a red glow, that it was taking place on our shore.
And that we're talking thousands of ships.
Well, I never saw them that day, but it was so obvious that it was taking place here. It was a real surprise, because we had been told almost the time, since we had been told to create sabotage for 10 hours after the signal, but we had never been told it would be here in Normandy.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
This beach was codenamed Sword. It's the northernmost part of that strip of beaches, codenamed Sword, Juno, Gold, and further on down, Omaha and Utah, separated by Amarones, where the artificial harbour was towed in. Early in the morning of June the 6th, 1944, the German sentries woke up to a terrifying sight. The sea, as far as they could observe, was packed with warships, and not German ones. At 7:20, 4th Commando went in here at Wistram. That included 170 specially trained Free French troops. Their objective, to take the huge stone blockhouse beside which I'm standing. They took it with some dispatch and moved down across the town, killing and capturing as they went. Within a very short time, the town of Wistram had fallen to the Allies. Below on the other beaches, other men, including many thousands of Irish, were landing. Some facing fierce resistance, but the real charnel house was down in Omaha and Utah, where the Americans were slaughtered by the thousand. What was the noise like? Was there firing? Was there...
Total. And unfortunately, we had an officer with us who was in charge of this, our boat, you know. And he was a bit of a guy that was, I think he was more afraid than us all. Don't put your head up. Don't be standing up. Walk by there. Keep down there. And we were, had us all worked up.
Where were the huge warships at this stage?
They were at the back, you know, as near as they could
so
come.
They're firing over the top
over
of
the
you?
Oh, they had to.
So the big guns are the likes of the Rodney and so on.
Yeah.
Throwing shells the size of rowing boats.
Absolutely.
That's over your heads towards the beaches.
Derek, you could nearly, as I told you, when you heard them firing, you know, you heard the big flash, and you instinctively looked, and you could see the shadow of them going over. I mean, you knew the shell was, they must have been huge things. You could feel nearly the wind of it, and then the sound of the gun would come at you then, the big guns, and they were firing in salvo. They were softening up all around, as you know, they were trying to soften up around Cannes. They hoped to get Cannes the first day, which they didn't, as you know. Yeah. And in the meantime, then, you were expecting stuff to come at you from this side as well, which fortunately it was pinging all right, but there was nothing. We heard a few pings around the side and that, but to be afraid of your life, you were taking glimpses and glances and wondering when they were going to open this thing in front of you.
How long did it take to get to the beach?
Well, we were manoeuvring around. It seemed to be messing. Do you know what I mean? We were saying, why don't you put us in there? Well, no, the beach had to, you had to get clearance if you were non-combatant, you know. And so eventually we got in about, I think it was the second third day, the morning of the third morning. So we were on board at night and all, which was ridiculous, you know what I mean? And you're hearing all this going. However, that seems to be, to me, that we were on such a high, you know what I mean, that I can only remember bits and pieces of it, if you understand me. Do you know what I mean? The whole feeling like was just to get in and get off this thing. I'm wondering, were we going to get off it without... Because we were fully expecting to meet that the enemy would be there, still firing at us.
Were all the dead and wounded cleared by the time?
Oh, no, no way, because they were around, you could see them floating on the waters even. You know, a lot of the guys who... What was happening with a lot of the boats, we could see them, some of the big, the smaller ones, the LSIs and the LSEs, the infantry and that. They were hitting banks, do you know what I mean? And instead of, when they dropped their thing then, the guys had run off or whatever it was on, and they were going into about 20 feet of water because there was still a bit to go, you know what I mean, in.
65 pounds on the back.
Oh, they go
down like a thing. Stone.
Yeah. I remember going down to the beaches about less than a week after that. I was scruffy. I needed a bath, I needed a shower, and there was no water and all that. Everything was a mess up where I was going around. And I went down to seek it out. You wouldn't put your foot in the water. And that was about a week after. You know, there was stuff floating in.
Blood
and butts of bodies. And it's when you tell people that now, they're agog. But you must remember there were hundreds lost in the water. Do you know
thousands
what I mean?
Even.
Thousands. And sunk. And, it normally takes about 9 days for a body to come up. But all that stuff on them, you know, they were loaded, the paratroopers and any of those people.
How did that affect you emotionally? Did the tragedy of those losses, did that hit you at the time?
It did. I tell you what happened with in my individual case is you expected that, you know what I mean? You expected there was going to be bodies and that, and you're wondering what your reaction was going to be. Were you going to be a coward, or would you, you know, this was the feeling, how am I going to react to all this? But I'd already seen a bit of it through the crashes in England. You know, I'd seen a few bad crashes and fellas, you know, that sort of thing, and helped to excavate them and all that sort of thing.
But the sheer scale of that courage.
That was, yeah, absolutely. And then the bedlam, because when you landed then, they were still undecided. You see, where I landed on Sword, there was, embankments and all around. So they were after bulldozing ways through them, you see. So there were little flags, and the guy was telling you, follow that little green flag, just to get, so you wouldn't be mixed up. So there was fellas getting stuck, and there was a lot of stuff was still being smouldering on the beach, and it was carnage, like, you know, and so the whole thing was a bit of a lure. Let's get out of here fast. We moved too fast, actually. We got on, and they sent us up a laneway and a roadway, and they said, keep going there, you'll hit the bridge eventually, blah, blah, blah. So eventually we were held up with tanks and all this right, because we were piling up then. And we ended up in a small laneway, and we shouldn't have stayed there at all, because when the tanks, you see, that I only discovered afterwards, if you're near tanks at all, that's where the enemy shell, because they see the dust. The dust comes up, and they're not too far. They're only 3 or 4 miles away at that stage. So we ended up in this laneway, and we said, we'll have to stay here till the morning. It's got dark. And I was up against a big tree, trying to have a sleep. And we parked the little truck down here, and my bike was over there. And then they started shelling. You know, these mini moaners. The sound of them. You'd hear them screaming. And this was our first time under shellfire. And I remember my main concern was my bike. And I always remember saying to the lads around the tree, that bloody bike, if that's hit, I'm finished. Because I'd left it up there by the ditch. And I crawled along on my hands and knees and pushed it down to the ditch, you know. And they said to me, you bloody idiot, you know what I mean? When I went back, there was two of them gone. Shell had come around the back of the tree.
Captain Michael Previte, family home at that time, Drimcong House, County Galway, was a Royal Marines officer, charged with getting his men, some of the British Army's crack troops, onto the beach. Captain Previte was by then 28, married to a Galway woman, and the father of a son.
There were two landing craft flotillas on board, and the Captain Poole had one flotilla and I had the other. And we both landed at the same time. Well, I led the landings on Gold Beach with my flotilla.
And what were your instructions or objectives
Upon landing, what were your orders?
My orders were to go back to the ship and pick up some more troops. Which we did.
Effectively to act as ferryman?
More or less, but we had to go ashore. There were stakes on the shore with explosives on the top of the stakes, but we landed, you see, at on a rising tide, at low tide, but at a rising tide. So the stakes, the top of the stakes were well above the boat, and then we had to get out and push the boat off.
I'm told that on some of the beaches, particularly the American beaches, there was a delay, with the result that they hit those underwater entanglements, the mines, the obstacles.
Very likely.
And they got enmeshed with them.
That's probably what happened. Mind you, they had bigger boats than we had. They had different shaped boats. And ours were different kinds of landing craft to the Americans.
I'm told that some of the boats ran aground while they were still in maybe 20 feet of water because they hit sandbanks, and men were lost because they jumped out with these heavy packs on into maybe 15 or 20 feet.
I was lucky because there was no hindrance like that at Gold Beach, nor at Swords. And those are the only two that I really know anything about.
What kind of opposition did you encounter as you came in?
Nothing. Not that I know of. I didn't see any. The only thing that was these stakes on the shore with these explosives on the top. We didn't know anything about them. But the opposition came when we were going out, when the boats were going back to the ship. We were fired on them.
It was awful. I was here home with my parents, and I felt dreadful all day, and I was following our gardener around, whom I was very fond of, who said, "What is the matter with you?" I said, "I don't know." And certain time that evening, it lifted. And he was back after they'd been mined.
Safe and sound.
Safe and sound. I never thought anything would happen to him.
But something...
But it was terribly anxious and lonely.
You knew, of course, that during the previous 4 years or so, the British Army had suffered appalling losses.
Oh, dreadful, dreadful.
But it never crossed your mind?
No. I had a conviction that he was going to come through. But it didn't alter my anxiety. I still felt that. Especially when D-Day, of course, I knew what was happening because, he disappeared after emergency leave, wasn't it? You had special leave before, and I thought, well, this must be it now. Of course, we were all sworn to silence, complete silence. You couldn't say anything to anybody. It was tricky.
Do you and Michael ever reminisce about those days, those war years?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
We had such fun, you know. You had to. Everybody was wonderful. They were all so cheerful and welcoming. And our time on Hailing Island, when I got seen off the beach watching an air raid, it was marvellous. And the Navy were there, and we shared a flat with another Royal Marine couple. And there were parties in between all these horrors. We watched Portsmouth burning, which was dreadful. Dreadful.
Flying at about 250 miles an hour, straight in towards France. Spitfires on the left and behind us. And somewhere with us, one other Mosquito, gone out of sight at the moment, who's flying with us as another extra machine with the formation.
Well, for years, I've been used to describing things, but I find it difficult to tell you just how this looks. In front of the great mass of shipping, there's the great pattern of France, cratered and re-cratered where our bombs have fallen in the past. Here is the new landing strip, lying out, looking for all the world like an old established and magnificently prepared aerodrome. We're diving down and coming in over it right now. flying straight over the top. And there, in the distance, and all round us, in a great semicircle, is the battle front. I can see the whole of it from east to west. Fires are burning in every direction. There's smoke going up in clouds. We've seen the guns firing and the ships firing inshore. And we're flying so low now that I can see individual people on the ground. There are anti-aircraft guns. There are some cows sitting in a field. I'm describing them all as they go past the port side window of this mosquito cockpit. More guns, and there are transport on the roads. And at that road junction, just below us, there's a military policeman waving them on. You know, I can even see his red cap from here, but he's wearing that and not his tin hat. The roads are full of our transport.
And now that I'm caring, you've
gone. Tom, did you have to kill anybody during your campaign? Do you reckon?
Well, I've been asked this before, and I don't like talking about it, but since you've asked the question again, I will answer you this way. There was one I remember. One outstanding feature was the two Germans came out from a wooded area with the hands in the air and a white cloth, which I just happened to notice at say the last minute there was a grenade under it, so I put him and grenade away.
Did it make you closer to God? Did you become religious?
Oh God, yes. Oh God, I have to admit to that. So I had my rosary beads in my hand, in one hand, my rifle in the other.
And the bayonet fixed as well.
I had to have the bayonet fixed, yes. If I just mentioned, there were two chaps killed within a stone's throw of me. You were told, ordered, stay in that trench, do all you had to do with it. Drop your pants if necessary. But these two, for whatever reason, I'll never know, went out of the trench, and the sniper got the two of them.
That was it.
It was a lesson well learned.
Did you eventually get the sniper?
No. Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah. We discovered that he was strapped to a tree overlooking our position. Yes. And it was a funny thing that every time the wind would blow, he'd go with it. And you'd shoot it straight away, but you wouldn't hesitate. You'd let shoot fire straight away without thinking. You wouldn't do it. Didn't do it too often. Like, you caught on yourself. Isn't that stupid?
In this corner of the Bayou Commonwealth War Cemetery, you can hear birdsong, the sound of a motor mower, carefully tending some 4,000 or more graves. And we're standing beside a line that begins with R.H. McQuillan, the Royal Ulster Rifles Airborne, who died on the 7th of June, the day after D-Day in 1944, aged 21. There are other inscriptions in proud and ever-loving memory of a very gallant soldier, Irene and children. And Colonel Chilcott, a row of Irish names. Do you have any feeling as a military historian and as somebody with a committed interest to this, do you have any feeling about the way in which those Irish heroes have been ignored by Ireland?
Yeah, I do. I think it's grossly unfair. We all know about, because I'm Anglo-Irish myself and I was brought up in an Irish family, and I know a lot of the feelings that went backwards and forwards. But these chaps went off and fought in a crusade, effectively. And this crusade is unacknowledged because of prejudice and all that sort of thing. And I think it's quite wrong, because they did their stuff along with everybody else.
I spoke to one veteran some years ago and I asked him about this moral ambivalence, and he said to me, "Young man, when you've seen children hanged from lampposts, let me assure you there is no moral ambivalence."
No, quite. No, I can see that. Yeah. Or if you've seen people, my father, for instance, was one of the first people into Belsen concentration camp.
Thank you.
there were some very beautiful people and brave men and honourable men, and to think that there, you know, there was absolutely no recognition really for them in that sense. Well, I agreed that they're getting around to it now. I go to the one every year up in Kilmainham, you know, for all the Irish war dead. That's good, at least they're there. And it's sort of happening. I find now, I'm a school teacher and I've been lecturing in the college, I do a bit of lecturing in the colleges, and I find now that I can bring it up discreetly, and they're very interested, the younger people. They want to hear a bit of the history. They want to hear why or what. Or what. Where before, it was in for a dig, you know what I mean? You just weren't supposed to do that. But now, and I've had requests from various groups of people, will I talk to them about it? They want to know.
60 years ago, Sean Deegan was part of a mighty war machine, dedicated, albeit, to the liberation of Europe. And now, 60 years later, you're a Franciscan friar, as I say, still in uniform. Do you still serve those men, those fallen men, and those former comrades, at least in the sight of God, do you think?
I think so. I think I'm in the unique position, I probably only one became a friar of all of them, and I'm in the unique position that I'm one of God's, what would you call it, disciples, if you like to put it. Like I'm in his little clan, I'm in his army, maybe closer than the average guy because I've dedicated my life to it. And I firmly believe that I have been given that privilege, that honour, to represent the Irish people, the Irish war dead, the forgotten heroes. And I have no hesitation now in speaking out now publicly or anyone. I don't care what sort of flack I get. That is my crusade at the moment, to try and perpetuate them. I know I haven't much longer to live, and they're probably, I'd hate it just to die out history, to be airbrushed out of history like that. I really would. I think knowing them, I can become very emotional about it.
Men like André Ainz, the resistance leader,
yeah,
speak passionately in admiration of those Irish men who volunteered.
Because they were unique. They were volunteers, Derek. Do you know what I mean? They weren't just being pushed into it. They were
Today, Europe celebrates its unity and democracy, and the fallen of both sides are acknowledged by their governments. Young men, on whose graves was built the freedom that we enjoy. A victorious Germany would have turned Ireland into a huge collective farm, its citizens slaves of the Reich. And yet Ireland chooses to ignore the 165,000 of its citizens who went to war, and the many thousands who never came home. The Europe, of whose presidency we have been so proud, was built with Irish bones too. Ignored here, perhaps, but remembered elsewhere.
Well, I was going to say, nobody can forget them here. And there's a village near that cemetery you were talking about, where we have the those Irish soldiers buried there on the 7th of June and the 8th of July. And in Caen, it's all the time that you think of that time. And we can't forget all those people, and we keep an immense gratitude to the for those men that were volunteers, as you say, and all the others. And we were so shocked at the time when it seems that the Americans despised us fairly recently, because we were not in favor of joining them, as if we were cowards. Now we kept the same feeling and the same immense gratitude, as I said, for all those heroes.
André Ainz, merci de tout.
Non, c'est vrai. We can't forget. No.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.